Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we donated a bunch to an African village and they were like, that's not helpful.
And then they got paved over and everybody was sad.
Yep.
So, and hooray, please. Books!
Yay, books! You did it again! So, this time around, we read The Color Purple by Alice Walker, a classic, written in 1982, won the Pulitzer, well, I don't know if it was written in 1982, published in 1982, and won the Pulitzer Prize in 1983, and was later made into a movie directed and produced by Steven Spielberg, of all people, which I found out when I was Googling the book. And it's now like a musical on Broadway, which seems weird to me, but
I have trouble picturing that, but then on the other hand, I can see how you might start to pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a fair number of characters in the book already sing anyway, so it's not, like, out of completely nowhere, but
yeah, there's,
Broadway,
like, a through line of, like, club jazz-era club music, I guess. Maybe you could do, I mean, I have no idea what's in the musical, because, of course, I haven't done any research, but you can do, like, some Basie Ellington-era big band stuff with jazz-type vocals on top of it, and I would think that was a cool show.
Yeah, I'd be down. But I also have no clue what the music sounds like or anything, so I don't know if that's what they do.
Right.
Because I did some research, but God knows I wasn't going to do any more than that.
Well, I mean, what do people expect from a podcast? Professionalism?
That's ridiculous. I will say that out of, like, all of the weird things that have happened to me, like, in terms of, you know, someone bringing up something that, like, I just read or saw, I was out for dinner last night with a group of people because it was one of my friend's birthdays, and out of basically nowhere, as far as I could tell, someone mentioned The Color Purple, and I was like, oh, I just read that book. And she's like, oh, no way, like, what did you think? And we ended up talking about The Color Purple, and I was like, this is so weird. I'm pretty sure, like, no one's ever brought up that book to me before.
I'm reasonably certain the same.
So I told her we were about to record it for a podcast, and she was like, I will definitely listen into that one.
All right. Well,
so we have one listener.
I'm sorry in advance for the disappointment you're about to receive from listening to this podcast.
So I guess a little bit of why we chose The Color Purple. We were kind of due for another classic type novel. And Ben and I, you know, are continually trying to make ourselves less shitty white people, so we decided it was about time to read a classic written by someone who was not a white person.
Which, by the definition of classics as they're used in education, is actually kind of tougher than you would think or hope.
Yeah, we definitely had, like, a, oh, we should do this, and I think I tried to Google just, you know, like, classics written by, I don't even remember what it was, but I might have just been like not white people, I don't remember, but you know, you had a couple of the ones pop up. I think a James Baldwin popped up, and Native Son popped up, and something else, but when I just run down the list of what I had to read in class, it's like white person, white person, white person, white person, white person, white person, white person. So
yeah, white person, white person, white person, Uncle Tom's Cabin, white person, white person, white person.
Uncle Tom's Cabin was written by a white person, though.
Was it?
Yeah, Harriet Beecher Stowe was a total whitey.
Oh, I always thought, I actually always assumed she was black. Well, it just goes to show what I know.
I had to, like, not study that book, but I read up a little bit on the publishing history of that book for a class. And, yeah, she was, like, a fairly well-off white woman. I think she was a northerner and, like, had written all these other books, so she was, like, fairly popular and was like, hey, slavery sucks ass, so I'm going to write this book about it. So, fun publishing history fact. Uncle Tom's Cabin was, like, at the top of, you know, was, like, a best-selling book for however many years. And at the same time that Uncle Tom's Cabin was a bestseller, Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave, which you might recognize from the movie that came out a couple years ago, was also a bestseller. So it was, like, in 1863, or I don't remember exactly what year, you had a woman and a black guy at the top of the bestseller list.
Huh.
And that's, like, something that doesn't even always happen in 2015 or 2016, so.
Right.
Oh, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, at least I learned something today.
Yeah. Not research enough for the podcast, but thank school for that one.
That's right.
And the other kind of thing that we wanted to bring up about this book is that it is one of the more frequently challenged books, according to the American Library Association. And you know that we like to read challenged and banned books.
Yeah.
Here at Novel Ideas.
We do, and usually be puzzled over the reason people would challenge them, or at least not understand how censorship works. I will say, I do understand why this book might make someone uncomfortable right off the bat.
Oh my goodness, yes. When I was looking up some reviews of this, some people, you know, actually commented, like, this is a great book, but the first chunk of it is really difficult for me to read because, like, the trauma, and especially if, like, you've ever gone through anything in your life that makes you more sensitive to that, I can understand how it would not be a good time.
Yeah,
I guess we should mention there's, like, some pretty messed up stuff going on, so just so everyone knows, you might get a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I guess in the era of trigger warnings, this would qualify.
Yeah.
Because the cold open of the book is a sexual assault.
Yes. On the main character, who is 13 or 14?
Yeah.
By the man she thinks is her father.
Yeah.
So
I'll admit, even I was taken aback by that.
Yeah, I actually basically knew nothing whatsoever about this book going into it, except that I knew that the main character, like, faced rape. And that was pretty much the only thing I knew about the book. And then I started it, and I was like, oh, well, that happens on page one. Okay. So, guess I don't have to wonder, like, when that's going to start. Like, the terrible stuff is going to start happening.
Right. Though, as opposed, because we've had this discussion a couple times in the history of this podcast, certainly, and I think it is one of those favorite internet debate topics. But anytime there is rape in a book, everyone starts clamoring over whether it's actually necessary to the book or not. And I mean, rightfully so. It's become kind of a misguided rather than a reflexively bad trope, but especially when a male author is trying to write a strong female character, they like to make them face the possibility of rape at some point in the story.
Yes.
Or Game of Thrones, where you don't, you know, there are certainly are people who think that it's unnecessarily prurient, and other people who think it's just germ refusing to allow us to forget what a crap sack world it is.
Yeah, I mean, you can make arguments if you're in a medieval-y setting, like, that shit is, especially, like, a conquering war setting, that stuff is going down. a lot.
And I think not acknowledging it at all is not very realistic, but I also sympathize with the people who think that there's too much of it.
Too much of it, yeah. That's kind of where I fall.
Yeah.
Like, I understand, dude, but come on. Like, okay.
Right, could we go maybe 3 chapters without a reference to it every once in a while?
Yeah.
Whereas in this book, I think it is unquestionably necessary to the characters in the book and the development of the story.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that too, and that in this case, she's not just having it happen so that the main character has some bad stuff happen to her, so you're like, oh no! Like, it's actually, you know, demonstrating a fact of life for people at this time in this place.
Yeah.
To give you an idea of, you know, I guess if you're arguing the game of that Gurm is doing it, to kind of remind us that that type of setting, that stuff was going on, I think it's kind of the same thing here, although I would say handled better in The Color Purple, where, you know, one of the points that she's making is not only oppression of black people, but of women within that subset, and that's, like, definitely a factor that comes into play, so.
Yeah.
It is, it's not pleasant, but at the same time, it feels like an important thing to include.
Yeah, and I put my seal of approval on all of that.
Ben, I'm sure many people will be happy to know that you you agree. Okay. So just really quick before we get started into all the other stuff going on in the book, just a little bit of background. So the format of this novel, it's an epistolary novel, which means that it's all in the form of letters. Seely, who is the main character, her letters feel more like she's just writing in a diary, but in letter form almost, and then later on they become more like letters to her sister, and then we also get letters from her sister Nettie to Seely, but the whole thing is just letter writing. So that's always kind of an interesting, tactic, because stuff has to get filtered through, and then like when it's happening, and there's a bunch of stuff you have to play with there. And as far as other genre elements, Ben and I both kind of think that this book might classify as a coming-of-age story, even though it's not about, like, a young teen who finds their way by the end of the book, but about a young teen who is in her 60s at the end of the book and has
right.
come to a good place in her life.
It's not like a traditional coming-of-age story, but I think it has a lot of the beats and a lot of the character development, and I mean, maybe arguably when you're talking about someone coming of age, having that happen when you're in your 50s or 60s is actually a lot more accurate than when you're a fucking teenager.
Yeah. But it does feel like, I kind of hesitate to use the term because it does feel a little insulting almost, like, yeah, it's a coming of age story, even though, like, you know, that's so strongly associated with, like, YA-type novels. But yeah, we're trying to use it more or less in the sense of, like, we think Seely is, like, a teenager, and more in the sense of, like, she rises up out of her terrible situation and, like, learns to love herself and be at peace with the world around her, which is a struggle that is significant enough that it takes her more than, you know, like, a summer to do that, so.
Right, it takes more than one episode of a TV series for someone to figure out all of their horrible psychological baggage.
Surprise.
And, yeah, I mean, I think we are hesitating just because coming of age is so strongly associated with becoming an adult rather than becoming just comfortable with yourself in general.
Yeah.
Because it's certainly not like she couldn't take care of herself. I mean, really, she essentially was in that position from the time she was 14.
Yeah, like, running a household, taking care of children, doing a ton of work. Like, she's definitely doing all of that.
Dear God, raising children when you're 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, imagine if you could have done that when you were 14.
No thanks.
So, plot synopsis, true to form in the style of the book.
Yes, dear God, you're a dick. See,
which actually threads of that are kind of accurate, so we'll talk about that later. Essentially, to give a super brief summary, Seeley, who's a teen in rural Georgia in, we don't know exactly when, but like, I don't know, like 1900s, she grows up in a family with a bunch of kids. When she's 13, 14, her father rapes her, and she ends up having two kids that she thinks he kills, but he actually just, like, sends away. So she actually ends up running into her daughter, and this other family, like, across town or something, has adopted her children. And then she gets married off to this dude by her dad, and basically has to, like, raise all of his kids and keep his household. And her husband's in love with another woman named Shug, who's, like, a performer. And she ends up getting invited to the household. And it turns out that Seeley and Shug, like, get along super well and really care about each other and end up developing this, like, really close relationship and kind of kicking the husband out of it. So at the same time, Seeley's sister, Nettie, who stayed with her briefly but then ended up running off because Seeley's husband was getting all creepy on her, she goes and finds the family that adopted Seeley's children. They become missionaries in Africa. So, like, at the same time as you have, like, Seeley's plot kind of dealing with, like, the extended family that she has going on and, like, all the issues that they're going through, you have Nettie then in Africa writing letters about what they're trying to do there. And Nettie's story is more one of how British people, or I guess not just British people, but, like, white people moved into Africa and started fucking everything up for their own purposes, and how it, like, totally screwed over everyone who lives there, and that's super depressing. And then at the end of the book, the sisters are finally reunited after, like, 30 or 40 years apart from each other. So it actually does have, like, a happy ending.
Yeah, there's a long string of abuse of every form abuse exists in throughout the book, and then it has a surprisingly, like, really kind of happy, content type of ending to it.
Yeah, and surprisingly.
Yeah, and one that's actually, that actually makes sense with what has happened, which is part of the reason it's a award winner and a classic, I suppose, because yeah, that could easily have been the tacked-on happy ending because the author thought that it had been too sad up to that point.
And that's one of the things that I kind of read about the movie version, is it feels more sentimental and like a series of heartstring moments with the happy ending tacked on at the end. I guess some people viewed the movie more that way, so maybe something was, like, lost in translation to film there, but I haven't seen it, so, like, I can't say for certain whether or not that's true.
I do have trouble picturing Spielberg making this book into a movie.
Yeah. He's, like, apparently super into it, so I don't know what that's about, necessarily.
Right, it just doesn't seem to fit his style of filmmaking, is mostly what I'm saying. But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
And fun fact, Whoopi Goldberg plays Seeley in the movie.
And Oprah is...
Oprah.
I say Oprah is involved?
Oprah is Sophia.
Huh.
So there you go.
All right. Why not?
So the book is set in rural Georgia, and we already mentioned it's like written entirely through letters, and it's very clear that Celie is our protagonist. So let's talk about her a bit.
Yeah, so Celie is kind of, I guess when you first meet her especially, she's kind of beaten down and abused, and she's not really, I mean, not surprisingly, not very comfortable or happy with her lot in life. She shows some, like, early signs of having some inner strength, just being able to, you know, trying to protect her sister despite the horrible inequity of her position.
That's what I was going to say, is that, like, when she's afraid that her father is becoming disinterested in her and is going to move on to her younger siblings, she actually, like, puts herself in harm's way knowingly, trying to protect them from going through that, which is really freaking brave.
Yeah. And, I mean, even to some degree, there are a couple of times where people comment she keeps good house and is doing a good job with those kids, which on one hand is kind of patronizing nonsense, but on the other hand, she's like 16 and trying to keep a house and raise kids.
And apparently all the kids are like terrible, and so everyone's really impressed that she puts up with them.
Right.
One of the things that she says early on when she gets married off to Mr., that I thought was, I don't know, it's like a moment of triumph, but also ridiculously sad, is when she's like, oh yeah, you know, my dad's marrying me off, and this, my new husband's gonna expect me to have a bunch more kids. She's like, but he doesn't know that I can't have kids anymore, because she got so screwed up from her first two pregnancies, like, something happened to her where she just, you know, can't get pregnant anymore, but she's, like, super excited about it, because she doesn't want to be forced to have more children. And I was like, good, and then I was like, no, that is terrible. It's, like, one of those really weird moments where you're, like, happy for, but also, like, fuck.
Insert birth control rant here, question mark? I mean, it's not exactly by choice, but at least she can be not pregnant.
Yeah. And the other thing we learn about her early on is that she's forced to stop going to school because she's having kids, and then she gets married off. But she was apparently, like, a really great student and super smart. So I kind of like Alice Walker throwing that in, because she's kind of making this point. The book is written more in, like, the way that she speaks, as opposed to, like, what we consider, you know, standard English. And a lot of the time you're like, oh, if someone talks like that and writes like that, then they're stupid. That's kind of the stereotype that just happens. And so here it's pointing out, like, no, she's actually, like, really bright and knows what's going on and just didn't have the chance to get the education to go beyond that, so. Yeah, and of course, and there are people who would argue that writing in standard English, you know, is not necessarily something everyone should aspire to. Like, why is it the highest pinnacle of whatever, so.
True. Celie herself doesn't really think that she's all that bright for, I don't know, maybe the whole book in some ways, but like, she has people, when she's, the handful of times she's in a pretty good situation, she does go about learning things and displays intellectual curiosity and later quite a bit of creativity when she starts making pants.
Yes.
And, like, shows a lot of the hallmarks of what you see from intelligent people, certainly.
Uh-huh.
And I was told that she was dumb and ugly a lot when she was young.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder how ugly she's supposed to be, if people are just saying that because you know, people are assholes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... My suspicion is that she's probably not particularly ugly, but just beaten down and never looks very happy, and probably is just... That's not someone who is going to usually put across a great impression.
Yeah.
As far as appearance goes, and hardly their fault.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's the abused. I think it's the abuse rather than the reality in that case.
Yeah. I'd say that's probably a fair interpretation, considering like her sister is supposed to be, Nettie is supposed to be really attractive, and like the two of them look enough like each other that Celie's kids look like they could be Nettie's kids, so.
Right. And for that matter, Nettie is pretty well educated by the time all is said and done. And she definitely thinks that Celie is as good a student as anybody.
Yeah.
So we have evidence. Yeah. We have evidence from the non-assholes that Celie is, in fact.
Totally.
And so, by kind of the story, that part of the reason we think it's a coming-of-age story is because Celie starts as kind of this beaten-down, abused figure, and by the end of the book has completely, like, reimagined what love and family are, for that matter, what the nature of God is, what the nature of the universe is. She, like, has her own successful business that she runs with employees. And is kind of, I mean, kind of becomes the matriarch of her extended family and friends group in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Becomes, like, a respected and impressive figure.
Yeah.
And I think one of the... the things that really shows that, so, you know, she gets up the strength and the courage to leave her shitty husband who doesn't do anything and go be with Shug, who she loves, and, you know, Shug is very, what's the word I'm trying to look for, supportive of Celie, you know, coming into her own. And at the end, when Celie and her husband, like, meet up again, they end up becoming friends, and he, like, actually grows to respect her as a person, and is like, you know, let's, can we try to be married again, like, as partners this time? And Celie totally rejects him, which is amazing, but I think it shows how, like, before, and I mean, he changes too, but he's like, oh, she's my wife, I dominate her, she does whatever I want. And then at the end, he's more like, oh, shit, like, you know, she's someone to be respected, so.
Yeah, and it gets, I mean, I guess not too surprisingly, so to talk about Mr. or Mr. underscore, because it does that Mr. with a dash thing that some books do.
Yeah.
Who we later find out is named Albert.
Yeah.
Like, he actually kind of, I mean, he's never depicted extremely sympathetically, I think, but he starts as kind of this tyrannical character who, the longer you see him, the more pitiful and pathetic he seems, and finally gets to the point where I think, at least, I mean, Shug for sure, and I think Celie as well, at a minimum, there may have been another one in there too, but tell him what a weak, pathetic character he is.
Yeah.
Finally.
It's great.
And he kind of, I mean, to his credit, not that it cancels out all of the abusive things he did, but he does seem to realize the truth of it, and by the time he's older, at the end of the book, he has mellowed quite a bit and realized that he's not really anything.
Yeah.
Actually, he wishes he had talked to Celie, for example, as an equal much earlier.
Yes, yeah. Like, what the fuck was I thinking? Yeah, his whole thing, I think, is he has kind of that complex where he wants to be, like, the big man in charge, but then his father is also, like, a very domineering personality, and he never quite has the, like, courage or conviction to stand up to his father. And so when he wants to marry Shug, his dad says, no way, and he's just not brave enough to say, you know, screw you, like, I want to. And so he gets forced into these marriages he doesn't want to really be in, and then I think to kind of make himself feel better, he's just a total asshole and completely dominates Celie and, like, makes her do everything because he can't do what he actually wants to do. And as you kind of realize that's what's going on, he's, like, still completely in love with Shug, but he still can't go against his father, and all that, then you just kind of start realizing, like, oh, this dude is, like, pretty pitiful.
Yeah, well, like, trying to kind of desperately seize control of things, because he really...
Yeah.
You know, he wanted Nettie, but he couldn't have her, but then she comes to live with them for a bit after Celie and Albert get married, and then he's kind of creeping on Nettie, and he gets turned down and kicks her out, and then he, for decades, hides all of her letters from Celie.
Yeah.
That's the biggest
dick move he does, probably.
Well, yeah, and it puts Celie in a... like a homicidal frame of mind for quite a while.
Yeah. She thinks that he's died and then finds out that he's just been hiding all of her letters for years, and Celie literally writes, like, she's gonna murder him, and the only thing that's stopping her is other people going, okay, don't murder him. Yeah.
It was pretty darkly humorous, I have to say, though. Like, the blackest of black comedy, her in a murderous rage was actually, in a way, like, kind of the funniest part of the book.
Well, I have to say, I sometimes also fall into murderous rage, so I can definitely sympathize. And I think that's, like, kind of, that might be one of the inciting things that finally convinces her, like, I'm gonna get out of here, because it's pretty soon after that when... Shug's gonna take off, and Celie's like, I'm going with her, and Albert's like, you can't go, and she's like, watch me, asshole.
Yeah. You're lucky I don't stab you right here. Trying to keep me away from, like, the only couple things in my life that I actually love and bring me joy. I'm not sticking around with you to let you do that anymore.
Yep, it's great. That was one of my more enjoyable moments in the book. Like, she's just like, I'm getting the fuck out. Peace.
That's right. She had a good role model in Shug Avery.
Yes. Let's go ahead and talk about Shug.
Yeah, let's. So Shug is, I think, in a... I think you could call her a free spirit. I think in a more lighthearted story, you definitely would.
Yeah.
But she's more of a... She's just someone who knows what she wants, and she does it.
Yeah, I think the really impressive thing about Shug is that in this time and in this place, women, and especially black women, would not be able to do a lot of this stuff, and she just totally books convention and does it, and people let her and, like, admire her and respect her for it, and so she's, like, a very strong personality.
Yeah, and she's the most powerful person in the book, and, I mean, externally as well, because she's doing so well with her singing gigs and touring around with that she's actually fairly wealthy, too.
Yeah. Yep. And she's not necessarily, like, stereotypically attractive, but she's just, like, she's one of those people who, like, is attractive to everybody just because... her force of will is so strong, kind of thing.
Yeah, I could kind of picture that, actually.
Yeah, and she acts kind of... So there's, like, a point in the book where she falls really sick and everyone thinks she's going to die, and Celie nurses her back to health and kind of helps her become a little bit less of a shitty person, I would say. And in return, Shug gets Seeley's husband to stop beating her. And they start talking a lot. And Shug realizes that Seeley has just been abused her whole life and has never had a positive sexual experience, and is like, all right, like, let's start teaching you about this, and kind of like learns her up on it, and they actually like start taking up a sexual relationship that lasts for like the rest of the book. Yeah. Really,
like, on and off, kind of on and off, mostly on, over years and years and years after that.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that really helps Seeley, like, start to heal, is realizing that she can love somebody, and that she can, like, physically be in this, like, good place with somebody, because she's never had that before. And having that, like, trust and equality in that relationship is really a good, positive thing for her.
And I think you can see some of the early sign, and another one of the early signs that Seeley is tougher and more clever than she lets on, because Shug was pretty much going to let herself starve to death, I think, during this illness, and Seeley was, through a combination of being clever and being just more stubborn, was able to get her out of it.
Yeah. I'm going to sit here with this food and eat it really slowly, and I think she, like, she's eating, she's like, well, I'm going to eat my breakfast, and then she, like, sets the food down and, like, walks out of the room to go get something, and she comes back and, like, the plate's clean.
Yep.
And Shug's like, oh, I don't, doesn't say anything. Seeley's like, ha-ha.
Nobody who can smell ham and gravy and not want to have a bite.
Yeah.
I was like, amen. I wanted it. It was making my mouth water reading about it.
That was actually another scene that made me laugh, when Shug's like, what do you have to eat? And Seeley, like, lists this, like, huge list of food, and she's like, that's all you have? And I was like, oh my god, all that sounds delicious.
Yeah, right? Down home cooking. I love it.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have, like, two other important women to talk about.
Yeah, I was going to say, as long as we're talking about strong women, there's Sophia, the, who kind of is an unfortunate character, because she kind of gets forced in the opposite direction, because she's the feisty, strong, won't take shit from nobody character who ends up getting very unfairly crushed beneath the boot heel of society.
Yeah, she's a lot like Shug in that she's not going to let people push her around, and she's going to do what she wants, but then, yeah, unfortunately that ends up backfiring for her. One of the things that's so great about Sophia early on is that, so she's married to Seeley's stepson, and he decides, because he sees his dad order around and beat his wife, that he needs to order around and beat his wife. And when he tries to do that to Sophia, she just beats the crap out of him. And it's like, I don't think so. And she eventually just, like, takes the kids and just leaves him to go stay with her sisters, because she doesn't want to deal with this shit anymore. But, yeah, she ends up, oh my god, in this scene that is just pure madness. She's in town, and it's the mayor's wife, right?
Yeah.
Sees her, and she's like, oh my gosh, you take such good care of your children, they're so clean. And she's like, thanks. And she's like, well, because you keep your kids so clean and healthy, do you want to come to my house and, like, be my maid and take care of my kid and, like, keep my house clean? And Sophia's like, well, she's to say, like, hell no. I think she says hell no. And because she's telling a white woman to, like, mind her own fucking business, because just because I keep my kids clean doesn't mean I want to be your maid.
Right.
Which is, like, the most insane jump in logic, I think, ever. But
it's such a...
So this woman's like, oh. But yeah, Sophie ends up, like, going to prison for... She's talking back, and then she, like... I think she, like, punches the mayor in the face, and...
Well, I think the mayor might have slapped her for sassing his wife.
Yeah.
And then Sophia being Sophia was like, I don't care if you're the white mare, no one's gonna just slap me for no reason.
Yeah.
And slugs him.
Yeah, so she ends up going to prison, which is not good for her, and then her, like, respite, I guess, is the mayor's family says, well, she can get out of prison early if she comes and works for us for X number of years. And her prison sentence is, like, ridiculously long.
Yeah, for their, like, work release is to be their maid with maybe half a day off once a month for the next 15 years.
Yeah, it's freaking absurd. Like, oh, she's gonna be in prison for like 20 years for like punching a guy, and I was like, holy god, like, it's a very, like, that situation is really interesting, and it's really sad because Sophia definitely still maintains like her spirit, but, you know, can't raise her children and is forced into the situation she doesn't want to be in, and it's like, it's solely because of racism.
Yep.
And it's just a total unfair societal thing that she has no power to change.
And it breaks her for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of is starting to pull out of it by the end of the book, I think. Starting to get some of it back, but not, like, she's disconnected from her family and is trying to reconnect with all these people, but doesn't really... has kind of had all the attitudes stomped out of her, and, I mean, there are definitely supposed to be some parallels, I think, between what we're seeing in the United States and what Nettie is seeing over in Africa, and that's my attempt to smoothly segue for once into talking about a different character, but... Oh. you know, Celie's sister, Nettie, who's always been the pretty smart one... Or I should say, pretty comma smart one.
Yes.
And kind of hooks up with this missionary family. And it's a... Because I think this is a choice that actually could have taken that part of the story in a different direction. But they're a black missionary family. So she's...
Yes.
Not... I mean, she kind of is, I guess, the... personal servant to the family, more or less, right? That's kind of her role initially.
Yeah, kinda.
I mean, she ends up being friends with them, with a couple of small waves, especially towards the end of the wife's life. But
yeah,
ends up marrying the guy, the reverend, eventually. But. She's kind of seen things through this idealistic lens, and she's always been the more innocent one anyway, which is part of why Celie was trying to protect her.
Yeah, because she, even though she grew up in this pretty bad setting, she was shielded enough by Celie and wasn't forced to marry this guy and was allowed to continue her education that she's maintained a lot of that innocence. So when she goes to Africa... it really does not occur to her for a while that, I guess, like, even though she travels overseas and has seen all this stuff, she doesn't really become a more worldly character until later in her life.
Yeah, I mean, not really until bad things start happening over there.
Yeah.
Because, like, she's taken so off guard when... What was the family's name? But anyway, when the wife becomes sick and...
I remember the wife's name is Corinne, but I don't remember what her last name is.
Yeah, like some... I think some combination of, like, actual jealousy and feverishness has her starting to... be upset about Nettie's relationship with her husband before she passes away, and that kind of catches Nettie off guard on a personal level. And then, you know, like the villagers, so they kind of get along with these villagers. I think the villagers kind of like the missionaries. They, I think, are more amused by them than anything else.
Yeah. But they don't, like, actively dislike them.
Right. They're like, oh, well, here are these people, and they have their different beliefs that are kind of silly, and, you know, they're...
I think they like that they get to go to school.
Yeah, they like their, that they can get some form of education out of the situation.
Yeah.
And, I mean, since these missionaries can't really do anything to prove that their God has any power that these villagers are unfamiliar with, they're just not all that convinced that they need to convert.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, after they've been there for years, here comes the white corporate colonial people who are just paving a road from point A to point B, and village happens to be in the middle of it, and instead of diverting it a couple hundred yards to leave the village intact, they just pave right on over it.
Yes. And that's where stuff starts getting insane. Like, Ben and I were talking about this, how you hear a lot about horrible ways Africans are treated, and but then every time you read about something, it's just, it's kind of shocking all over again just how terrible it is. And this book was no exception for me, because it's talking about how the rubber company moved in, completely destroys all of the gardens and growing areas all the native people have, and forced them all to plant and grow rubber, so they can't, they can't grow their own food supply anymore. They're, like, basically forced into slavery by being forced to plant and grow rubber. I don't think they're getting paid for it, because the company's just taking all the rubber. The river that the villagers had running right outside their village becomes property of the company, and they have to pay for clean water. They have to pay to, like, build new huts, because all their old ones got knocked down for the road. It's just shocking how completely heartless their treatment is.
Yeah, it's a mindset that just I struggle to understand in the first place. And, you know, there's, it's one of those questions of injustice, I guess, that you can go back and examine through modern eyes and just not understand how it got to the point where people thought that was an okay thing to do in the first place.
Yeah, like, that's, like, just what kept blowing my mind.
Yeah, like, it's one thing to engage in predatory corporate practices and try to drive other businesses under. It's another thing to de facto enslave a group of people and then, like, sell them their own resources that have always been theirs.
Yeah, that they were, like, doing just fine before, and then, yeah, it's mind-boggling how, and the thing that makes it the most horrible is that that shit actually happened. And so if you ever, you know, wonder, like, what does colonialism do? Why is it bad? Like, read The Color Purple, and you'll get a whole terrible tale of how a bunch of, I mean, in addition to, you know, hundreds of years before, a bunch of Africans being enslaved and taken away and shipped over the ocean, then the people who were still there got their entire way of life destroyed and were forced into slavery there. So, I just, it makes me really
upset.
Yes.
Like, not even, I mean, angry, yes, but just upset. It's upsetting.
Yeah. I just don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we're right around the moral issues part of this anyway.
Yeah.
So we just kind of ranted and rampaged about colonialism, which was on the list. And actually, for that matter, the racism behind Sophia's arc.
Yes.
So one of the interesting aspects of the book were kind of the way that some of the family issues and relationships were handled.
Yeah.
People would just, I mean, basically every named character at some point in the book, it seems, ups and leaves their spouse and frequently comes back with a new lover or children or both, or like just the fluidity of the relationships and how that's like that's never really no one really raises an eyebrow at any of that. That's kind of par for the course, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting and kind of cool how there was like really no moral judgment from other characters. If, you know, Sophia's like, I'm sick of the way my husband's treating me, and she like writes to her sisters, and they're there like the next day, carting up her and the kids, and they're like, we're out of here, and like no one even is like, that's, you shouldn't do that, that's not fair. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Have fun. Harpo's an idiot, so get out of here. And yeah, when Celie leaves her husband, and yeah, there's a lot of that. I think at one point, the character Mary Agnes, whose nickname is Squeak, because she's like very meek person, she decides that before she decides that she's going to leave, Celie makes some comment like, well, don't you have family somewhere that you can just like up and leave and take your kids and go stay with them for a while? Like, that's kind of, it's interesting that they are not hemmed in by issues of like divorce or being forced to stay there by the family. Like, they kind of always have this option of escaping any sort of like toxic thing.
Well, there's kind of, yeah, it is kind of weird because there does seem to be an attitude with a couple of the men in this book that being married does give them the right to beat their wife, but that somehow, despite marriage being an institution powerful enough to allow you to do that, is not powerful enough to require people to stay in it if they don't like it.
Yeah.
But then they don't really bother with the format. No one really bothers with the formality of divorce. Sophia leaves and then comes back and then ends up in jail, and Harpo takes up with Squeak, and like, there's, as far as I know, there are no formal arrangements within any of that.
Yeah, and then Sugar gets married, and then her husband goes off with Squeak for a while, and like that whole time Sugar and Celie are like, are still together. So it's pretty interesting, and very, very different, but it was cool to see, like, a different way of characters interacting and how, like, relationships worked.
Yeah, and I guess, moving things along a bit, but I think we were touching on this idea a little bit earlier, but of course, because this is a novel idea, it's feminism.
Well, also because this book is full of it.
Well, yeah, and this one is, I mean, that is part of the theme of the story, I think, is the idea of women supporting each other and banding together and being able to do the things they want to do, and how important that is to having a good life and growing into yourself and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, and in the end, you know, so Celie's been, like, so mistreated by these men in her life who are terrible. She has Shug and she has her sister Nettie, and really heals, like, through her relationships with other women who help her and support her and encourage her to grow and buy her pants.
Right.
as opposed to the men who just want to, you know, beat her down and be in charge of her. So there's really a lot of, or like when Sophia gets sent to prison and Squeak basically watches and raises her children. And then when Squeak goes off and Sophia's, like, finally done with her thing, she's going to take care of her kids, like, in return. And it's almost like they do it without even really worrying about it or questioning it. Like, there's no, oh, the kids are going to be abandoned. Someone's like, oh, no, I'll definitely take care of your children. So it's, those relationships are really powerful. And I think, you know, one of the things going on here is there's definitely, like, the racism element, considering where they live and when. But then there's also this element of, you know, within being part of the oppressed class and race, then women are even, like, further oppressed within that subset, and they really need each other to kind of break out of some of that shit that's holding them down.
Yeah, and it's all on a, you know, again, there's not, I mean, not that this kind of, not that that relationship, I guess, would be formalized necessarily, but it's not as much like a spoken thing as some sort of, like, emotional bond that comes to exist. But you don't hear anybody talking, I mean, you really don't hear anybody talking in this book about, you know, sisterhood and we got to watch out for one another. It's just, they're friends and they've been around each other a long time and they just, you know, they kind of take care of each other.
Yeah, I would say that's a good point. Like, whereas in some books they're like, oh, women have to stick, like, it's super obvious. And I mean, it's obvious in this book, but it's done in a way, like you said, without people making comments that, like, cheapen it at all. It's just, like, the way it works, and you just get it from the sense of how they interact, as opposed to them saying stuff outright. Like, Alice Walker does not feel the need to put in very obvious
yeah,
lines of dialogue to help point you in that direction.
The message is strong enough without having to have a side conversation about sisterhood at some point.
Yeah. And the other important thing I think that happens in this book is sexuality. Like, one of the things I found really interesting is that Celie, her relationship with Shug, which is romantic and sexual, and I thought, oh, wow, like, you don't really see that often in classics. This is, like, pretty cool. And then you think, well, you know, Celie's been faced so much horrible shit at the hands of the men in her life. Like, it totally makes sense why being with a woman would be way better for her. But then I thought it was cool how at the end of the book, when Albert, you know, kind of, like, reproposes to her and is like, oh, we become, like, husband and wife again. And she says, like, she makes this comment about how she thinks men look like frogs. She's like, I still think men look like frogs. Sorry about that. Like, I'm not interested. So I thought it was cool because it was basically the statement of Celie is, I mean, not in so many words. And I don't know if you, like, if it's cool to put the label of lesbian on her considering, like, the time and all that stuff, but I mean, she's not sexually interested in men, and that's never considered, like, this terrible thing that people judge her for. It's just like, no, she's in this caring, loving relationship, and, like, that's what makes her happy, and there you go.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, really, like, her relationship with Shug is always portrayed as, like, this positive healing thing for Celie, and another thing that does not happen in this book is that that relationship is never, like, a point of conflict. No one's ever like, oh, what is this, you know, what is this unnatural thing? That never comes up.
Yeah.
And, I mean, honestly, we've kind of been trained in some ways to look for people doing that, for that to be a conflict, for that to be a part of the point of the story being told. I mean, how easily for, the book's written, published in the early 1980s, so, I mean, it's not super duper old, but it's not hard to imagine a story with a similar plot thread where part of the arc of Seeley learning who she is and healing would be some sort of weird marrying a man related quote redemption unquote sort of thing at the end.
Yeah.
Which would have been a horrifyingly bad decision. And not one, in this book, not one you would expect. Like, nothing at that was even begun to be hinted at any point.
Yeah, this book never... Yeah, I agree with you that, like, a lot of times when people write those sorts of relationships, it becomes a dramatic point in almost all of them.
Yeah.
Like, oh, these two characters, yeah, they're in a relationship. That's not normal. I'm going to make sure that... someone tries to beat them up or yells at them or they feel bad about it or, like, you right. know, like, whatever the else crap else happens to, like, LGBT characters. And in this one, it was, yeah, it's just, like, a powerful affirmation. It was a good thing. No one had any problems with it. There was, like, no discussion of, like, oh, my gosh, is this okay? Like, so... I was like, damn, this is freaking awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you really do get a lot of the messages and themes out of this book that other stories have touched on, but they're handled... It's handled while it's still giving the same basic message of love good, being an asshole bad. Does it in... Like, gets the message across very strongly, but does it using a... Just approaches it differently than most stories. It doesn't... beat you over the head with an Aesop.
Yeah, and that was, like, one of my favorite things about the book is we've talked about before when we've read these types of books that have, like, a lot of issues in them, that sometimes it feels like the author is just putting those issues in there so that they can have addressed those issues, and you feel a little bit like they're kind of beating you over the head with it, or just putting it in there for the sake of putting it in there. And this book never feels like it's doing that. All of the stuff that comes up feels like it's part of the story, and it feels natural and not forced, and it's never used just for the sole point of, like, creating drama, which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, we've joked about with a handful of the YA books we've read, especially both ones we've liked and ones we haven't, but, like, the teen issue checklist.
Which
you really need to add to the novel ideas dictionary lexicon at some point, I think.
Yeah.
Because that has come up a few times, but yeah, that's part of what made the book. And not to get all the way ahead, because I want to touch on a theme or two first, but that is, the book does read like something that should have won awards, and it did.
Yeah.
And not really in the award bait type of way
that yeah.
some read like, or maybe a little less commonly with books. Some books do read that way. I think some movies that are made with that in mind can get really bad about that.
Oscar bait films.
Oh, they're the worst.
Yeah, that you can tell was made for the pure purpose of trying to get an Oscar nomination.
And it even works sometimes, and that's even worse than that.
Yeah.
But...
The movie of this book did get nominated for, like, a ton of Oscars, but it didn't win any.
Which is probably why the things you read about it were somewhat muted in their praise, perhaps.
Yeah.
So we were talking about the idea of women supporting each other, that is something that is such an important part of Seeley's healing and growth as a person that that is one of the more obvious themes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of this idea a little bit also of with, I think, age and experience bringing wisdom and perspective, because virtually every character is wiser and mellower and better able to live with the people around them by the end of the book. Even
yes.
Even Mr. Albert underscore, who is a tyrannical douchebag for 80% of the book.
Yeah.
And then, kind of interestingly, because there's a foreword to my edition of the book where Alice Walker says, hey, this book is really supposed to be about God and the nature of God, and I'm surprised more people don't see that. I mean, after all, the first words of the book are, dear God. And that was actually not something I would have found terribly obvious if she hadn't said that. But there's kind of a turning point in the middle of the book, the best support for that, where Seeley kind of comes to a new understanding. There was a conversation with Suge, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
Where she says, God, you know, if you think of God as being this old white man, well, then, you know, of course that's going to make you miserable because old white men don't give a shit about people like us.
Uh-huh.
God is, you know, everything. Trees and rocks and you name it.
Like a very naturalistic, God is all around us. God is not like a man or a woman. It's just this like sense of like what's around you, helping you, supporting you, that sort of vision of God, as opposed to, yeah, to the God in the white man's Bible,
right.
Which is, yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of a turning point for Seeley, because she stops writing her journal to God and starts writing it to Nettie, her sister. And, you know, at the same time that's going on, you have these missionaries in Africa who are trying to convert natives and not doing it very successfully. And they kind of bring up this cool point where Seeley, or Nettie, is saying how when they get to the village, they get told, you know, these leaves that they use to cover the roofs of their huts that keep the rain out are almost like a god to them because of this like backstory, and kind of bringing in this point of like a nature-based god and how you use it, you should use God more as like whatever protects you and supports you and makes you feel better. And the missionaries, like, in this grand scheme of things, end up being pretty worthless and unable to use their Christianity to help the natives out. So this kind of idea of like the traditional Christian God is kind of tossed out in favor of this more inclusive one.
I mean when you're someone like Seeley, I don't know why. I mean, she kind of, was it before that conversation, even when she started writing her letters to Nettie instead of to God?
Yeah, because I think that conversation happened because she told Suge, I stopped writing to God because he's a man and men never did anything for me.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess kind of the thing about that theme of that was less obvious is that aside from titling all of those letters or diary entries or whatever they were, dear God, all the time, like you weren't really getting a lot of that message. There was like a brief encounter with the reverend's wife, and then Nettie was really seeing more of it than Seeley. So it's kind of happening, a lot of the God related stuff, I guess, was happening away from the protagonist. It was only maybe more in hindsight that, and the foreword where Alice Walker wrote the book, then I believe her.
Yeah.
But that it became more obvious that that was supposed to be part of the theme as well.
Yeah.
Any episodes, points of interest you want to touch on? Anything we left out?
Everything that wanted to talk about, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about some of the things we liked about how the book was written already. There's some... the character interactions actually are pretty interesting. Sometimes fun. There's a little bit of wittiness in there at times when appropriate. Occasionally some very direct dialogue and conversations that, I don't know, the book's presented pretty straightforwardly. I think there are a lot of messages and ideas kind of wrapped up in what's going on, but the prose is pretty direct for the most part.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And because it's divided up into letters, it's pretty easy to get through. You know, if you have just a couple minutes, you can read a couple of them and get... like a discrete chunk of story, or if you want to sit down and read a bunch of them in a row, that was also easy to do.
Yeah, the divisions made it pretty easy to like read it for basically any length of time.
Yeah. And I mean, it was, we found plenty to talk about. There was some pretty powerful stuff in there. I think it was really well done. And like we were saying just a couple minutes ago, I really liked that some non-traditional approaches were taken to traditional types of issues, but that still got the same message across as some of those more traditional approaches, but where the author didn't have to grab you by the shoulders and shake you quite as often.
Yeah, that's like pretty much the only thing that I ever struggled with reading the book. I mean, I guess... aside a little bit from the content sometimes being fairly grim, was that because it covers such a wide period of time, it was occasionally a little confusing on how much time had passed. Celia might start an entry and be like, oh yeah, you know, now that Sophia's been in prison for 5 years, this is happening, and I'm like, wait, what? And so occasionally I was like a little unsure how much time had passed. But, you know, it does take her from, like, 14 to her 60s, so there are some, like, fairly big gaps. I mean, I appreciate that Alice Walker didn't just try to write, like, a 5,000-page book that covered that span of time. But that did mean that occasionally it was, like, a little confusing. But that's, like, a fairly minor complaint that I had.
Yeah, because it would be confusing for, like, a paragraph or a page. You'd go, wait, did they just gloss over a decade in a sentence?
Okay.
All right, okay. Readjusting. yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I think it's fairly clear that... I liked it. I thought it was well done. I don't need to recap everything I just said. Basically, the strengths of the writing kind of summarized pretty well why I thought it was interesting and good and powerful, and I definitely had something of an emotional response to it.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a good book to read. It still feels relevant.
Yeah.
For when it was written, and even though it's set, you know, 100-ish years ago, and it brings up good issues. I would be willing to let my high schooler, my, you know, theoretical future high schooler, not that I have a high schooler, read this book in class if, you know, the teacher did a good job with it. It feels more worthwhile than a lot of other classics that I've read, so yeah.
Alright, then that being said, what are you reading right now?
I just finished reading Horns by Joe Hill, aka Stephen King's son, on Friday. And I don't know if I ever mentioned on an older episode that I read Heart-Shaped Box like a year-ish ago, which is another book by Joe Hill. And I have decided that that's pretty good. I now know how he writes and what his stories are like, and I think I'm good.
All right.
I will say that I liked Heart-Shaped Box better than Horns. I actually found Horns lacking in a lot of areas and didn't like it that much. That's for another day.
All right.
And I'm currently listening to... I've been listening to a bunch of audiobooks because I've been going on... trying to go on long walks every day. So I've been getting a bunch of audiobooks through the library and stuff. I'm currently listening to a book called The Dead House by Dawn Kurtigich. I'm not 100% sure how to say her last name. I actually looked up ALA's like top recommended YA audiobooks for 2015, and then went and saw if they were available through the Boston Public Library, just because I was like, yeah, why not? So it's pretty interesting. I'm several hours away from the end, and I kind of have no idea what the F is going to happen. But it's pretty creepy. Pretty creepy story. It's like a girl who during the day is like one person and at night is a different person, and so like they think she has, you know, like the split personality thing going on, but then the teens are making like a fairly good argument that they actually are like two separate people in the same body, and then there's a bunch of stuff that goes on. It's pretty weird.
All right. Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So I read Kizumonogatari by a guy whose name is palindromic, and I don't know how to pronounce, Noyasin or something along those lines. This will not surprise anybody. It's a light novel that was translated from the original Japanese. And it involves a guy who gets turned into a vampire and retrieving the body parts of the vampire who made him into one, but it's actually more complicated than that, and it's rather silly.
That's not something I usually... this story about, you know, killing a vampire, whatever, it's pretty silly.
Yeah, it was rather silly. Even though it kind of has some dark overtones at times. And then I read the Aeronauts Windless by Jim Butcher because, I don't know, I haven't read anything by Jim Butcher in a few months, I guess, so I had to.
That's a lot.
Yeah, kind of a fantasy steampunky setting that captures the idea of wooden ships doing combat on the high seas very well if those ships were airships with, like, magical ether cannons.
Hooray!
I actually thought it was pretty good. I mean, I like his stuff anyway, but it... read. I thought it was a little more mature than some of his other works. I think he's getting better as he continues to crank out books at an insanely prolific rate. So, I mean, I guess you hope so. You write a certain number of
eventually.
You write a certain number of millions of words, and you would hope, even by accident, you would grow a little bit.
Yeah.
So
at some point.
Yeah. So I guess if you have any questions, comments, whatever, you can leave them on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can also find us on iTunes with our beautiful new banner, and rate and review there. You can also subscribe to us. You can also find us, because we are part of the Minerva Podcast Network.
You need to start
find us.
Saying that at the beginning of the podcast, probably.
Yeah, that's actually what I just thought. But you can find us at MinervaMag.com, along with all the other podcasts and geeky things associated with that.
And you can find us on our respective Twitters. I run the at Novel Ideas Pod account. So if you're contacting us that way, then you're talking to me first, at least. Or Gab is at Classic Sum Up.
I am.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like classic sum up, but it's classic classic sum up because two S's in a row looked weird.
Next time, we will be doing The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. Which I guess is kind of a YA classic by very much a white person. since we're trying not to overdo that anymore. But
she is a white British lady, yeah. But there are some interesting topics of colonialism to talk about in the book.
Indeed.
So.
I've started it, and I've already... Well, I mean, they're pretty heavy at the very beginning of it, for one thing, but...
I can
see where we'll be going with some of that. But anyway, I think that's going to do it today. And
indeed.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.